and for politeness' sake he shrugged his shoulders only inwardly when men of Mizraim asserted that Egypt had been the earliest home of man, being as it was the center and navel of the world. The curly-bearded folk of Shinar, of course, they too believed that their kingly city, called by them the Gateway of God, and bond between heaven and earth, Bab-Ilu, Makas, Same Ur-Usitim. The boy Joseph could repeat the words glibly after them. In other words, that Babel was the sacred center of the earth. But in this matter of the world navel, Joseph had better and more precise information, drawn from the personal experience of his good and solemn and brooding father, who, when a young man on his way from Seven Springs, the home of his family, to his uncle at Haran, in the land of Naharaim, had quite unexpectedly and unconsciously come upon the real world navel, the hill town of Luz, with its sacred stone circle, which he had then renamed Beth-El, the house of God, because, fleeing from Esau, he had there been vouchsafed that greatest and most solemn revelation of his whole life. On that height, where Jacob had set up his stone pillow for a mark and anointed it with oil, there henceforth was for Joseph and his people the center of the world, the umbilical cord between heaven and earth. Yet not there lay paradise, rather in the region of the beginnings and of the home. Somewhere thereabouts, in Joseph's childish conviction, which was, moreover, a conviction widely held, whence the man of the moon city had once set out, in lower Shinar, where the river drained away, and the moist soil between its branches even yet abounded in luscious fruit-bearing trees. Theologians have long favored the theory that Eden was situated somewhere in southern Babylonia, and Adam's body formed of Babylonian soil. Yet this is only one more of the coulisse effects with which we are already so familiar, another illustration of the process of localization and back-reference, only that here it is of a kind extraordinary beyond all comparison, alluring us out beyond the earthly in the most literal sense and the most comprehensive way, only that here the bottom of the well which is human history displays its whole, its immeasurable depth, or rather its bottomlessness, to which neither the conception of depth nor of darkness is any longer applicable, and we must introduce the conflicting idea of light and height, of those bright heights, that is, down from which the fall could take place, the story of which is indissolubly bound up with our soul memories of the Garden of Happiness. The traditional description of paradise is in one respect exact. There went out, it says, from Eden, a river to water the garden, and from thence it was parted and came into four heads, the Pison, Gihon, Euphrates, and Hiddekel. The Pison, it goes on to say, is also called the Ganges. It flows about all India and brings with it gold. The Gihon is the Nile, the greatest river of the world, that encompasseth the whole of Ethiopia. But Hiddekel, the arrow-swift river, is the Tigris, which flows towards the east of Assyria. This last is not disputed, but the identity of the Pison and the Gihon with the Ganges and the Nile is denied with considerable authority. These are thought to be rather the Araxes, which flows into the Caspian Sea, and the Halys, which flows into the Black Sea, and accordingly the site of paradise would still be in the Babylonian sphere of interest, but not in Babylon itself, rather in the Armenian Alpine country north of the Mesopotamian plain, where the two rivers in question have their sources close together. The theory seems reasonably acceptable, for if, as the most regarded tradition has it, the Frat or Euphrates rose in paradise, then paradise cannot be situated at the mouth of that river. But even while with this fact in mind we award the palm to Armenia, we have done no more than take the step to the next following fact. In other words, we have come only one more coulisse further on, God, so old Eliezer had instructed Joseph, gave the world four quarters, morning, evening, noon, and midnight, guarded at the seat of the Most High by four sacred beasts and four guardian angels, which watch over this fixed condition with unchanging eyes. Did not the pyramids of Lower Egypt exactly face, with their four sides covered with shining cement, the four quarters of the earth? And thus the arrangement of the rivers of Paradise was conceived. They are to be thought of in their course as four serpents, the tips of whose tails touch, whose mouths lie far asunder, so that they go out from each other towards the four quarters of the heavens. This now is an obvious transference. It is a geography transferred to a site in near Asia, but familiar to us in another place, now lost, namely in Atlantis, where, according to Plato's narrative and description, these same four streams went out from the Mount of the Gods, towering up in the middle, and in the same way, that is, at right angles, to the four quarters of the earth. All learned strife as to the geographical meaning of the four headwaters, and as to the site of the garden itself, has been shown to be idle, and received its quietus through the tracing backwards of the paradise idea, from which it appears that the latter obtained in many places, founded on the popular memory of a lost land, where a wise and progressive humanity passed happy years in a frame of things as beneficent as it was blessed. We have here an unmistakable contamination of the tradition of an actual paradise with the legend of a golden age of humanity. Memory seems to go back to that land of the Hesperides, where, if reports say truth, a great people pursued a wise and pious course under conditions never since so favorable. But no, the Garden of Eden it was not. It was not that site of the original home and of the fall. It is only a coulisse and an apparent goal upon our paradise-seeking pilgrimage in time and space. And our archaeology of the earth's surface seeks for Adam, the first man, in times and places whose decline and fall took place before the population of Atlantis. What a deluded pilgrimage! What an onward-luring hoax! For even if it were possible or excusable, however misleading, to identify as paradise the land of the golden apples where the four great rivers flowed, how could we, even with the best will in the world to self-deception, hold with such an idea, in view of the Lemurian world, which is our next and furthest time coulisse, a scene wherein the tortured larva of the human being, our lovely and well-favored young Joseph would have refused with pardonable irritation to recognize himself in the picture, endured the nightmare of fear and lust which made up his life, in desperate conflict with scaly mountains of flesh in the shape of flying lizards and giant newts. That was no Garden of Eden. It was hell. Or rather, it was the first accursed state after the fall. Not here, not at the beginning of time and space, was the fruit plucked from the tree of desire and death, plucked and tasted. That comes first. We have sounded the well of time to its depths, and not yet reached our goal. The history of man is older than the material world, which is the work of his will, older than life, which rests upon his will. A very ancient tradition of human thought, based upon man's truest knowledge of himself, and going back to exceeding early days, whence it has become incorporated into the succession of religions, prophecies, and doctrines of the East, into Avesta, Islam, Manichaeanism, Gnosticism, and Hellenism, deals with the figure of the first, or first completely human, man. The Hebraic Adam Kadmon, conceived as a youthful being made out of pure light, formed before the beginning of the world as prototype and abstract of humanity. To this conception others have attached themselves, varying to some extent, yet in essentials the same. Thus, and accordingly, primitive man was, at his very beginning, God's chosen champion in the struggle against that evil which penetrated into the new creation. Yet harm befell him. He was fettered by demons, imprisoned in the flesh, estranged from his origins, and only freed from the darkness of earthly and fleshly existence by a second emissary of the deity, who in some mysterious way was the same as himself, his own higher self, and restored to the world of light, leaving behind him, however, some portions of his light, which then were utilized for the creation of the material world and earthly creatures. Amazing tales, these, wherein the religious element of redemption is faintly visible behind the cosmogonic frame. For we are told that the original human Son of God contained in his body of light the seven metals to which the seven planets correspond, and out of which the world is formed. Again it is said that this human light essence, issuing from the paternal primitive source, descended through the seven planetary spheres, and the Lord of each partook of his essence. But then, looking down, he perceived his image mirrored in matter, became enamored of it, went down unto it, and thus fell in bondage to lower nature. All which explains man's double self, an indissoluble combination of godlike attributes and free essence, with sore enslavement to the baser world. In this narcissistic picture, so full of tragic charm, the meaning of the tradition begins to clarify itself. The clarification is complete at the point where the descent of the child of God from his world of light into the world of nature loses the character of mere obedient pursuance of higher order, hence guiltless, and becomes an independent and voluntary motion of longing, by that token, guilty. And at the same time, we can begin to unravel the meaning of that second emissary, who, identical in a higher sense with the light man, comes to free him from his involvement with the darkness, and to lead him home. For the doctrine now proceeds to divide the world into the three personal elements of matter, soul, and spirit, among whom, and between whom and the deity, there is woven the romance whose real protagonist is the soul of mankind, adventurous and in adventure creative, a mythos which, complete by reason of its combination of oldest record and newest prophecy, gives us clear leading as to the true site of paradise and upon the story of the fall. It is stated that the soul, which is to say the primevally human, was, like matter, one of the principles laid down from the beginning, and that it possessed life, but no knowledge. It had, in fact, so little that, though dwelling in the nearness of God, in a lofty sphere of happiness and peace, it let itself be disturbed and confused by the inclination, in a literal sense implying direction, towards still formless matter, avid to mingle with this, and evoke forms upon which it could compass physical desires. But the yearning and pain of its passion did not diminish after the soul had let itself be betrayed to a descent from its home. They were heightened even to torment by the circumstance that matter sluggishly and obstinately preferred to remain in its original formless state, would hear nothing of taking on form to please the soul, and set up all imaginable opposition to being so formed. But now God intervened, seeing nothing for it, probably, in such a posture of affairs, but to come to the aid of the soul, his errant concomitants. He supported the soul as it wrestled in love with refractory matter. He created the world. That is to say, by way of assisting the primitive human being, he brought forth solid and permanent forms, in order that the soul might gratify physical desires upon these and engender man. But immediately afterwards, in pursuance of a considered plan, he did something else. He sent, such literally are the words of the source upon which I am drawing, he sent out of the substance of his divinity spirit to man in this world, that it might rouse from its slumber the soul in the frame of man, and show it, by the Father's command, that this world was not its place, and that its sensual and passional enterprise had been a sin, as a consequence of which the creation of the world was to be regarded. What in truth the spirit ever strives to make clear to the human soul imprisoned in matter, the constant theme of its admonitions, is precisely this: that the creation of the world came about only by reason of its folly in mingling with matter, and that once it parted therefrom, the world of form would no longer have any existence. To rouse the soul to this view is the task of the reasonable spirit. All its hoping and striving are directed to the end that the passionate soul, once aware of the whole situation, will at length re-acknowledge its home on high, strike out of its consciousness the lower world, and strive to regain once more that lofty sphere of peace and happiness. In the very moment when that happens, the lower world will be absolved. Matter will win back her own sluggish will, being released from the bonds of form, to rejoice once more, as she ever did and ever shall, in formlessness, and be happy in her own way.